Wolf Hall, Disc 16.
4 days. 50 barges in procession, furnished by the city livery companies, 2 hours from the city to Blackwall, their rigging hung with bells and flags, a light but brisk breeze as order from God in his prayers. Reverse order, anchor at the steps of Greenwich Palace, collect incoming queen in her own barge, Catherine's old one, rebadged, 24 oars. Next, her women, her guard, all the ornaments of the king's court, all those proud and noble souls who swore they'd sabotage the event. Boats packed with musicians, 300 craft afloat, banners and pennants flying, the music ringing bank to bank, and each bank lined with Londoners. Downstream of the tide, led by an aquatic dragon spitting fire, and accompanied by wild men throwing fireworks, sea-going ships discharge their ordnance in salute. By the time they reach the tower, the sun is out. It looks as if the Thames is ablaze. Henry is waiting to greet Anne as she lands. He kisses her without formality, scooping back her gown, pinning it at her sides to show her belly to England. Next, Henry makes knights, a shoal of Howards and Boleyns, their friends and followers. Anne rests. Uncle Norfolk is missing the show. Henry has sent him to King Francis to reaffirm the most cordial alliance between our two kingdoms. He is Earl Marshal and should be in charge of the coronation, but there is another Howard to step in as his deputy, and besides, he, Thomas Cromwell, is running everything, including the weather. He has conferred with Arthur Lord Lyle, who will preside at the coronation banquet. Arthur Plantagenet, a gentle relic of a former age. He is to go to Calais, directly this is over, to replace Lord Berners as governor, and he, Cromwell, must brief him before he goes. Lyle has a long, bony Plantagenet face, and he is tall like his father, King Edward, who no doubt had many bastards, but none so distinguished as this elderly man, bending his creaky knee in obeisance before Boleyn's daughter. His wife, Honor, his second wife, is 20 years his junior, small and delicate, a toy wife. She wears tawny silk, coral bracelets with gold hearts, and an expression of vigilant dissatisfaction bordering on the peevish. She looks him up and down.
"I suppose you are Cromwell."
If a man spoke to you in that tone, you'd invite him to step outside and ask someone to hold your coat. Day 2. Bringing Anne to Westminster. He is up before first light, watching from the battlements as thin clouds disperse over the Bermondsey bank, and an early chill as clear as water is replaced by a steady golden heat. Her procession is led by the retinue of the French ambassador. The judges in scarlet follow, the knights of the Bath in blue violet of antique cut, then the bishops, Lord Chancellor, Audley and his retinue, the great lords in crimson velvet. 16 knights carry Anne in a white litter, hung with silver bells which ring at each step, at each breath. The queen is in white, her body shimmering in its strange skin, her face held in a conscious solemn smile, her hair loose beneath a circle of gems. After her, ladies on palfreys trapped with white velvet, and ancient dowagers in their chariots, their faces acidulated. At every turn on the route, there are pageants and living statues, recitations of her virtue and gifts of gold from city coffers, her white falcon emblem crowned and entwined with roses, and blossom mashed and minced under the treading feet of the stout 16, so scent rises like smoke. The route is hung with tapestries and banners, and at his orders the ground beneath the horse's hooves is gravel to prevent slipping, and the crowds restrained behind rails in case of riots and crush. Every law officer London can muster is among the crowd, because he is determined that in time to come, when this is remembered and told to those who were not here, no one is going to say, "Oh, Queen Anne's coronation, that was the day I got my pocket picked." Fenchurch Street, Leadenhall, Cheap, Paul's Churchyard, Fleet, Temple Bar, Westminster Hall. So many fountains flowing with wine that it's hard to find one flowing with water. And looking down on them, the other Londoners, those monsters who live in the air, the city's uncounted population of stone men and women and beasts, and things that are neither human nor beasts, fanged rabbits and flying hares, four-legged birds and pinioned snakes, imps with bulging eyes and ducks' bills, men who are wreathed in leaves or have the heads of goats or rams, creatures with knotted coils and leather wings, with hairy ears and cloven feet, horned and roaring, feathered and scaled, some laughing, some singing, some pulling back their lips to show their teeth, lions and friars, donkeys and geese, devils with children crammed into their maws, all chewed up except for their helpless paddling feet, limestone or leaden, metalled or marbled, shrieking and sniggering above the populace, hooting and gurning and dry-heaving from buttresses, walls and roofs. That night, the king permitting, he goes back to Austin Friars. He visits his neighbour Chapuis, who has secluded himself from the events of the day, bolting his shutters and stuffing his ears against the fanfares, the ceremonial cannon fire. He goes in a small satirical procession led by Thurston, taking the ambassador's sweetmeats to ease his sulks, and some fine Italian wine sent to him by the Duke of Suffolk. Chapuis greets him without a smile.
"Well, you have succeeded where the cardinal failed. Henry has what he wants at last. I say to my master, who is capable of looking at these things impartially, it is a pity, from Henry's point of view, that he did not take up Cromwell years ago. His affairs would have gone on much better."
He is about to say, "The cardinal taught me everything," but Chapuis talks over him.
"When the cardinal came to a closed door, he would flatter it. Oh, beautiful yielding door! Then he would try tricking it open. And you are just the same, just the same."
He pours himself some of the Duke's present.
"But in the last resort, you just kick it in."
The wine is one of those big, noble wines that Brandon favours, and Chapuis drinks appreciatively and says, "I don't understand it. Nothing do I understand in this benighted country. Is Cranmer Pope now, or is Henry Pope? Perhaps you are Pope. My men, who were among the press today, say they heard few voices raised for the concubine, and plenty who called upon God to bless Catherine, the rightful queen. Did they? I don't know what city they were in." Chapuis sniffs. They may well wonder. These days it is nothing but Frenchmen about the king, and she, Boleyn, she is half French herself, and wholly bought by them. Her entire family are in the pocket of Francis. But you, Thomas, you are not taken in by these Frenchmen, are you? He reassures him, "My dear friend, not for one instant." Chapuis weeps. It's unlike him. All credit to the noble wine.
"I have failed my master, the Emperor. I have failed Catherine."
"Never mind." He thinks, tomorrow is another battle, tomorrow is another world. He's at the abbey by dawn. The procession is forming up by six. Henry will watch the coronation from a box screened by a lattice, sequestered in the painted stonework. When he puts his head in about 8 o'clock, the king is already sitting expectantly on a velvet cushion, and a kneeling servant is unpacking his breakfast. "The French ambassador will be joining me," Henry says, and he meets that gentleman as he's hurrying away.
"One, yes, you have been painted, Maître Cromwell. I, too, have been painted. You have seen the result?"
"Not yet. Hans is so occupied. Even on this fine morning, here beneath fan vaulting, the ambassador looks blue-tinged. Well," he says, "it appears that with the coronation of this queen, our two nations have reached the state of perfect amity. How to improve on perfection, I ask you, monsieur." The ambassador bows.
"Downhill from here?"
"Let's try, you know, to maintain a state of mutual usefulness when our sovereigns are once again snapping at each other."
"Another Calais meeting?"
"Perhaps in a year."
"No sooner?"
"I will not put my king on the high seas for no cause."
"We'll talk, Cromwell."
Flat palm, the ambassador taps him on the chest, over the heart. Anne's procession forms up at 9. She is mantled in purple velvet, edged in ermine. She has 700 yards to walk on the blue cloth that stretches to the altar, and her face is entranced. Far behind her, the Dowager Duchess of Norfolk, supporting her train, nearer, holding up the hem of her long robe, the Bishop of Winchester at one side, the Bishop of London at the other. Both of them, Gardiner and Stokesley, were king's men in the matter of the divorce. But now they look as if they wish they were far distant from the living object of his remarriage, who has a fine sheen of sweat on her high forehead, and whose compressed lips, by the time she reaches the altar, seem to have vanished into her face. Who says two bishops should hold up her hem? It's all written down in a great book, so old that one hardly dare touch it, breathe on it. Lyle seems to know it by heart. Perhaps it should be copied and printed, he thinks. He makes a mental note, and then concentrates his will on Anne. Anne not to stumble, as she folds herself towards the ground, to lie face down in prayer before the altar, her attendant stepping forward to support her for the crucial 12 inches before belly hits sacred pavement. He finds himself praying. This child, his half-formed heart now beating against the stone floor, let him be sanctified by this moment, and let him be like his father's father, like his Tudor uncles. Let him be hard, alert, watchful of opportunity, wringing use from the smallest turn of fortune. If Henry lives 20 years, Henry who is Wolsey's creation, and then leaves this child to succeed him, I can build my own prince, to the glorification of God and the Commonwealth of England, because I will not be too old. Look at Norfolk. Already he is 60. His father was 70 when he fought at Flodden. And I shall not be like Henry Wyatt and say, now I am retiring from affairs. Because what is there but affairs? Anne, shaky, is back on her feet. Cranmer, in a dense cloud of incense, is pressing into her hand the sceptre, the rod of ivory, and resting the crown of St. Edward briefly on her head, before changing for a lighter and more bearable crown. A prestidigitation, his hands as supple as if he'd been shuffling crowns all his life. The prelate looks mildly excited, as if someone had offered him a cup of warm milk. Anointed, Anna withdraws, incense billowing around her, swallowed into its murk. Anna Regina, to a bedchamber provided for her, to prepare for the feast in Westminster Hall. He pushes unceremoniously through the dignitaries. All you who said you would not be here, and catch a sight of Charles Brandon, Constable of England, mounted on his white horse, and ready to ride into the hall among them. He is a huge, blazing presence, from which he withdraws his sight. Charles, he thinks, will not outlive me either. Back into the dimness towards Henry. Only one thing checks him, the sight, whisking around a corner, of the hem of a scarlet robe. No doubt it is one of the judges, escaped from his procession. The Venetian ambassador is blocking the entrance to Henry's box, but the king waves him aside and says, Cromwell, did not my wife look well? Did she not look beautiful? Will you go and see her and give her... He looks around for some likely present, then wrenches a diamond from his knuckle. Will you give her this? He kisses the ring. And this too? I shall hope to convey the sentiment, he says, and sighs, as if he were Cranmer. The king laughs, his face is alight. This is my best, he says. This is my best day.
Until their birth, Majesty, says the Venetian, bowing.
It is Mary Howard, Norfolk's little daughter, who opens the door to him. No, you most certainly cannot come in, she says. Utterly not. The Queen is undressed. Richmond is right, he thinks. She has no breasts at all. Still, for 14. I'll charm this small Howard, he thinks. So he stands spinning words around her, complimenting her gown and her jewels, till he hears a voice from within, muffled like a voice from a tomb. And Mary Howard jumps and says, oh, all right. If she says so, you can see her. The bed curtains are drawn closed. He pulls them back. Anne is lying in her shift. She looks flat as a ghost, except for the shocking mound of her six-month child. In her ceremonial robes, her condition had hardly showed, and only that sacred instant as she lay belly down to stone had connected him to her body, which now lies stretched out like a sacrifice, her breasts puffy beneath the linen, her swollen feet bare. "Mother of God," she says, "can you not leave Howard women alone? For an ugly man you are very sure of yourself. Let me look at you." She bobs her head up. "Is that crimson? It's a very black crimson. Did you go against my orders?"
"Your cousin, Francis Bryan, says I look like a travelling bruise."
"A contusion on the body politic."
Jane Rochford laughs. "Can you do this?" he asks, almost doubting, almost tender. "You are exhausted."
"Oh, I think she will bear up."
There is no sisterly pride in Mary's voice.
"She was born for this, was she not?"
Jane Seymour says.
"Is the king watching?"
"He is proud of her."
He speaks to Anne, stretched out on her catafalque.
"He says you never looked more beautiful. He sends you this."
Anne makes a little sound, a moan, poised between gratitude and boredom. "Oh, what? Another diamond?"
"And a kiss, which I said he had better bring in person."
She shows no sign of taking the ring from him. It is almost irresistible to place it on her belly and walk away. Instead, he hands it to her sister. He says,
"The feast will wait for you, Highness. Come only when you feel ready."
She leaves herself upright with a gasp. "I am coming now." Mary Howard leans forward and rubs her lower back with an unpracticed hand, a fluttering virginal motion as if she were stroking a bird.
"Oh, get away,"
the anointed queen snaps. She looks sick. "Where were you last evening? I wanted you. The streets cheered for me. I heard them. They say the people love Catherine, but really, it is just the women. They pity her. We will show them something better. They will love me when this creature is out of me."
Jane Rochford says,
"Oh, but madam, they love Catherine because she is the daughter of two anointed sovereigns. Make your mind up to it, madam. They will never love you any more than they love Cromwell here. It has nothing to do with your merits. It is a point of fact. There is no use trying to evade it." "Perhaps enough," Jane Seymour says. He turns to her and sees something surprising. She has grown up. "Lady Carey," Jane Rochford says, "we must get your sister on her feet now and back in her robes. So, see Master Cromwell out and enjoy your usual confabulation. This is not a day to break with tradition." At the door,
"Mary," he says, notices the dark stains under her eyes.
"Yes?"
She speaks in a tone of yes, and what is it now?
"I am sorry the marriage with my nephew did not come off." "Not that I was ever asked, of course," she smiles tightly. "I shall never see your house. And one hears so much of it."
"What do you hear?"
"Oh, of chests bursting with gold pieces."
"We would never allow that. We would get bigger chests."
"They say it's the king's money."
"It's all the king's money. His image is on it." "Mary, look." He takes her hand. "I could not dissuade him from his liking for you. He..."
"How hard did you try?"
"I wish you were safe with us. Though, of course, it was not the great match you might expect as the Queen's sister."
"I doubt there are many sisters who expect what I receive, nightly."
"She will get another child by Henry," he thinks. "Anne will have it strangled in the cradle." "Your friend William Stafford is at court. At least, I think he is still your friend."
"Imagine how he likes my situation. Still, at least I get a kind word from my father. Monseigneur finds he needs me again. God forbid the king should ride a mare from any other stable."
"This will end. He will free you.
He will give you a settlement, a pension. I'll speak for you.
Does a dirty dishcloth get a pension?
Mary sways on the spot. She seems dazed with misery and fatigue. Great tears swell in her eyes. He stands, catching them, dabbing them away, whispering to her and soothing her, and wanting to be elsewhere. When he breaks free, he gives her a backward glance, as she stands in the doorway, desolate. Something must be done for her, he thinks. She's losing her looks.
Henry watches from a gallery high above Westminster Hall. As his queen takes her seat in the place of honour, her ladies around her, the flower of the court and the nobility of England. The king has fortified himself earlier and is picking at a spice plate, dipping thin slices of apple into cinnamon. In the gallery with him, encore les ambassadeurs, Jean de Danteville, furred against the June chill, and his friend the Bishop of Lavour, wrapped in a fine brocade gown.
"This has all been most impressive, Cromwell," de Selve says.
Astute brown eyes study him, taking everything in. He takes in everything too, stitching and padding, studding and dyeing. He admires the deep mulberry of the bishop's brocade. They say these two Frenchmen favour the gospel, but favour at Francoise's court extends no further than a small circle of scholars that the king, for his own vanity, wishes to patronise. He has never quite been able to grow his own Thomas More, his own Erasmus, which naturally piques his pride.
"Look at my wife, the Queen!"
Henry leans over the gallery. He might as well be down there.
"She's worth a show, is she not?"
"I have had all the windows reglazed," he says, "the better to see her."
"Fiat lux," de Selve murmurs. "She has done very well," de Danteville says. "She must have been 6 hours on her feet today. One must congratulate your majesty in obtaining a queen who is as strong as a peasant woman. I mean no disrespect, of course."
In Paris they are burning Lutherans. He would like to take it up with the envoys, but he cannot while the odour of roast swan and peacock drifts up from below.
Monsieur,
he asks, music rising around them like a shallow tide, silver ripples of sound. "Do you know of the man Guido Camillo? I hear he's at your master's court." De Selve and his friend exchange glances. This has thrown them.
"The man who builds the wooden box," Jean murmurs.
"Oh, yes. It is a theatre," he says. De Selve nods.
"In which you yourself are the play."
"Erasmus has written to us about it," Henry says, over his shoulder. "He is having the cabinet makers create him little wooden shelves and drawers, one inside another. It is a memory system for the speeches of Cicero."
"With your permission, he intends it as more than that. It is a theatre on the ancient Vitruvian plan, but it is not to put on plays. As my lord the bishop says, you as the owner of the theatre are to stand in the centre of it and look up. Around you there is arrayed a system of human knowledge, like a library, but as if... Can you imagine a library in which each book contains another book, and a smaller book inside that? Yet it is more than that." The king slips into his mouth an aniseed comfit and snaps down on it.
"Already there are too many books in the world. There are more every day. One man cannot hope to read them all."
"I do not see how you understand so much about it," de Selve says. "All credit to you, Maître Cromwell. Guido will only speak his own Italian dialect, and even in that he stammers."
"If it pleases your master to spend his money," Henry says. "He is not a sorcerer, is he, this Guido? I should not like Francis to fall into the hands of a sorcerer. By the way, Cromwell, I'm sending Stephen back to France."
Stephen Gardiner. So the French do not like doing business with Norfolk. Not surprising.
"His mission will be of some duration,"
de Selve catches his eye.
"But who will do Master Secretary's job?"
"Oh, Cromwell will do it, won't you?"
Henry smiles. He is hardly down into the body of the hall before Master Risley intercepts him.
This is a big day for the heralds and their officers, their children and their friends. Fat fees coming their way. He says so, and Coolmy says, fat fees coming your way. He edges back against the screens, voice low. One could foresee this, he says, because Henry is tired of it. Winchester's grinding opposition to him every step of the way. He is tired of arguing. Now he is a married man. He looks for a little more douceur. With Anne, he says, and Coolmy laughs. You know her better than me. If, as they say, she is a lady with a sharp tongue, then all the more he needs ministers who are kind to him. So devote yourself to keeping Stephen abroad, and in time he will confirm you in the post. Christoph, dressed up for the afternoon, is hovering nearby, making signals to him. You will excuse me, he says, but Risley touches his gown of crimson, as if for luck, and says, you are the master of the house and the master of the revels. You are the origin of the king's happiness. You have done what the cardinal could not, and much more besides. Even this, he gestures around him, to where the nobility of England, having already eaten their words, are working through 23 dishes. Even this feast has been superbly managed. No one need call for anything. It is all at his hand before he thinks of it. He inclines his head. Risley walks away, and he beckons the boy. Christoph says, one tells me to impart nothing of confidence in the hearing of Coolmy, as Ralph says he go cheat trot to Gardiner with anything he can get. Now, sir, I have a message. You must go quick to the Archbishop. When the feast is done, he glances up to the dais where the Archbishop sits beside Anne, under her canopy of state. Neither of them is eating, though Anne is pretending to. Both of them are scanning the hall. I go trit-trot, he says. He is taken with the phrase. Where?
His old lodging, which he says you know. He wishes you to be secret. He says not to bring any person.
Well, you can come, Christoph. You're not a person. The boy grins. He is apprehensive. Does not quite like the thought of the abbey precincts, the drunken crowds at dusk, without somebody to watch his back. Unfortunately, a man cannot have two fronts. They have almost reached Cranmer's lodging when fatigue enwraps his shoulders, an iron cloak. Pause for a moment, he says to Christoph. He has hardly slept these last nights. He takes a breath in shadow. Here it is cold, and as he passes into the cloisters he is dipped in night. The rooms around are shuttered, empty, no sound from within. From behind him, an inchoate shouting from the Westminster streets like the cries of those lost after a battle. Cranmer looks up. He's already at his desk.
These are days we will never forget, he says. No one who's missed it would believe it. The king spoke warm words in your praise today. I think it was intended I should convey them.
I wonder why I ever gave any thought to the cost of brick-making for the tower. It seems such a small item now. And tomorrow the jousts. Will you be there? My boy, Richard, is listed for the bouts on foot, fighting in single combat.
He will prevail, Christoph declares. Biff, and one is flat, never to rise again.
Hush, Cranmer says. You are not here, child. Cromwell, please. He opens a low door at the back of the chamber. He dips his head, and framed by the doorway in the half-light he sees a table, a stool, and on the stool a woman sitting, young, tranquil, her head bowed over a book. She looks up.
Ich bitte Sie, ich brauche eine Kerze.
Christoph, a candle for her. The book before her he recognises. It is attractive Luther's. May I, he says, and picks it up. He finds himself reading. His mind leaps along the lines. Is she some fugitive Cranmer is sheltering? Does he know the cost if she is taken? He has time to read half a page before the Archbishop trickles in like a late apology. This woman is, Cranmer says.
Margareta, my wife.
Dear God! He slams Luther down on the table. What have you done?
Where did you find her? Germany, evidently. This is why you were slow to return. I see it now. Why? Cranmer says meekly.
I could not help it.
Do you know what the king will do to you when he finds you out? The master executioner of Paris has devised a machine with a counterweighted beam, shall I draw it for you, which, when a heretic is burned, dips him into the fire and lifts him out again, so that the people can see the stages of his agony. Now Henry will be wanting one. Or he will get some device to tease your head off your shoulders over a period of 40 days. The young woman looks up.
Mein Onkel?
Who is that? She named a theologian, Andreas Osiander, a Nuremberger, a Lutheran. Her uncle and his friend, she says, and the learned men of her town, they believe... It may be the belief in your country, madam, that a pastor should have a wife, but not here. Did Dr. Cranmer not warn you of this?
Please, Cranmer begs. Tell me what she is saying. Does she blame me? Is she wishing herself at home?
No. No, she says you are kind. What took hold of you, man?
I told you I had a secret.
So you did. Down the side of the page. But to keep her here, under the king's nose.
I have kept her in the country, but I could not refuse her wish to see the celebrations.
She's been out on the streets.
Why not? No one knows her.
True. The protection of the stranger in the city. One young woman in a cheerful cap and gown. One pair of eyes among the thousands of eyes. You can hide a tree in a forest. Cranmer approaches him. He holds out his hands, so lately smeared with the sacred oil. Fine hands, long fingers, the pale rectangles of his palms crossed and recrossed by news of sea voyages and alliances.
I asked you here as my friend, for I count you my chief friend, Cromwell, in this world.
So there is nothing to do in friendship, but to take these bony digits in his own. Very well. We will find a way. We will keep your lady's secret. I only wonder that you did not leave her with her own family, till we can turn the king our way. Margarita is watching them, blue eyes flitting from face to face. She stands up. She pushes the table away from her. He watches her do it, and his heart lurches. Because he has seen a woman do this before, his own wife. And he has seen how she puts her palms down on the surface to haul herself up. Margarita is tall, and the bulge of her belly juts above the tabletop. Jesus, he says.
I hope for a daughter,
the Archbishop says. About when? He asks Margarita. Instead of answering, she takes his hand. She places it on her belly, pressing it down with her own. At one with the celebrations, the child is dancing. Spanoletta, a stampy royale. This is perhaps a foot. This is a fist. You need a friend, he says, a woman with you. Cranmer follows him as he pounds out of the room.
About John Frith,
he says. What?
Since he was brought to Croydon, I have seen him 3 times in private conversation. A worthy young man, a most gentle creature. I have spent hours. I regret not a second of it, but I cannot turn him from his path.
He should have run into the woods. That was his path.
We do not all...
Cranmer drops his gaze.
Forgive me, but we do not all see as many paths as you.
So you must hand him to Stokesley now, because he was taken in Stokesley's diocese.
I never thought, when the king gave me this dignity, when he insisted I occupy this seat, that among my first actions would be to come against a young man like John Frith, and to try to argue him out of his faith.
Welcome to this world below.
I cannot much longer delay,
Cranmer says. Nor can your wife. The streets around Austin Friars are almost deserted. Bonfires are starting up across the city, and the stars are obscured by smoke. His guards are on the gate, sober, he is pleased to note.
He stops for a word. There is an art to being in a hurry but not showing it. Then he walks in and says, "I want Mistress Barr." Most of his household have gone to see the bonfires, and they will be out till midnight dancing. They have permission to do this. Who should celebrate the new queen if they do not? John Page comes out. Something want doing, sir? William Brabazon, pen in hand, one of Wolsey's old crew. The king's business never stops. Thomas Avery, fresh from his accounts. There's always money flowing in, money flowing out. When Wolsey fell, his household deserted him, but Thomas Cromwell's servants stayed to see him through. A door bangs overhead. Ralph comes down, boots clattering, hair sticking up. He looks flushed and confused. "Sir?" "I don't want you. Is Helen here, do you know?"
"Why?"
At that moment, Helen appears. She is fastening up her hair under a clean cap. "I need you to pack a bag and come with me."
"For how long, sir?"
"I cannot say."
"To go out to London?"
He thinks, "I'll make some arrangement. The wives and daughters of men in the city, discreet women, they will find her servants and a midwife, some competent woman who will put Cranmer's child into his hands. Perhaps for a short time."
"The children?"
"We will take care of your children." She nods, speeds away. "You wish you had men in your service as swift as she." Ralph calls after her.
"Helen!"
He looks irate.
"Where's she going, sir? You can't just drag her off into the night."
"Oh, I can," he says mildly.
"I need to know."
"Believe me, you don't." He relents. "Or if you do, this is not the time. Ralph, I'm tired. I'm not going to argue." He could perhaps leave it to Christoph and some of the more unquestioning members of his household to take Helen from the warmth of Austin Friars to the chill of the Abbey precincts. Or he could leave it till the morning. But his mind is alive to the loneliness of Cranmer's wife, the strangeness of the city en fête, the deserted aspect of Cannon Row, where even in the shadow of the Abbey, robbers are bound to lurk. Even in the time of King Richard, the district was home to gangs of thieves who issued out by night at their pleasure, and when the dawn came, swarmed back to claim the privilege of sanctuary, and no doubt to share the spoils with the clergy. "I shall clean out that lot," he thinks. "My men will be after them like ferrets down a hole." Midnight. Stone exhales a mossy breath. Flagstones are slippery with the city's exhalations. Helen puts her hand into his. A servant admits them, eyes downcast. He slips him a coin to raise his eyes no higher. No sign of the Archbishop. Good. A lamp is lit. A door pushed ajar. Cranmer's wife is lying in a little cot. He says to Helen, "Here is a lady who needs your compassion. You see her situation. She does not speak English. In any case, you need not ask her name." "Here is Helen," he says. "She has two children of her own. She will help you." Mistress Cranmer, her eyes closed, merely nods and smiles. But when Helen places a gentle hand on her, she reaches out and strokes it.
"Where is your husband?"
"Abated. I hope he is praying for me." The day of Frith's burning, he is hunting with the king over the country outside Guildford. It is raining before dawn, a gusty, tugging wind bending the treetops. Raining all over England, soaking the crops in the field. Henry's mood is not to be dented. He sits down to write to Anne, left back at Windsor. After he has twirled his quill in his fingers, turned his paper about and about, he loses the will. "You write it for me, Cromwell. I'll tell you what to put." A tailor's apprentice is going to the stake with Frith, Andrew Hewitt. Catherine used to have relics brought to her, Henry says, for when she was in labour with her children. A girdle of the Blessed Virgin. I hired it. I don't think the Queen will want that. And special prayers to St. Margaret. These are women's things. Best left to them, sir. Later, he will hear that Frith and the boy suffered, the wind blowing the flames away from them repeatedly. Death is a japester. Call him and he will not come.
He is a joker, and he lurks in the dark, a black cloth over his face. There are cases of the sweat in London. The king, who embodies all his people, has all the symptoms every day. Now Henry stares at the rain falling. Cheering himself up, he says, it may abate, Jupiter is rising. Now tell her, tell the queen. He waits, his pen poised. No, that's enough. Give it to me, Thomas, I will sign it. He waits to see if the king will draw a heart. But the frivolities of courtship are over. Marriage is a serious business. Henricus Rex. I think I have a stomach cramp, the king says. I think I have a headache. I feel queasy, and there are black spots before my eyes. That's a sign, isn't it? If your majesty will rest a little, he says, and take courage. You know what they say about the sweat. Merry at breakfast, dead by dinner. But do you know it can kill you in 2 hours? He says, I have heard that some people die of fear. By afternoon, the sun is struggling out. Henry, laughing, spurs away his hunter under the dripping trees. At Smithfield, Frith is being shovelled up, his youth, his grace, his learning and his beauty. A compaction of mud, grease, charred bone. The king has two bodies. The first exists within the limits of his physical being. You can measure it, and often Henry does. His waist, his calf, his other parts. The second is his princely double. Free-floating, untethered, weightless, which may be in more than one place at a time. Henry may be hunting in the forest while his princely double makes laws. One fights, one prays for peace. One is wreathed in the mystery of his kingship. One is eating a duckling with sweet green peas. The Pope now says his marriage to Anne is void. He will excommunicate him if he does not return to Catherine. Christendom will slough him off, body and soul, and his subjects will rise up and eject him into ignominy, exile. No Christian hearth will shelter him, and when he dies his corpse will be dug with animal bones into a common pit. He has taught Henry to call the Pope the Bishop of Rome, to laugh when his name is mentioned. If it is uncertain laughter, it is better than his former genuflection. Cranmer has invited the prophetess, Elizabeth Barton, to a meeting at his house in Kent. She has seen a vision of Mary, the former princess, as queen. Yes. Of Gertrude, Lady Exeter, as queen. Yes. He says gently, both cannot be true. The maid says, I only report what I see. He writes that she's bouncing and full of confidence. She's used to dealing with archbishops, and she takes him for another Warham, hanging on her every word. She's a mouse under the cat's paw. Queen Catherine is on the move, her household much reduced to the Bishop of Lincoln's palace at Buckton, an old red brick house with a great hall, and gardens that run out into the copses and fields and so into the Fenland landscape. September will bring her the first fruits of autumn, as October will bring the mists. The king demands that Catherine give up for his coming child the robes in which the child Mary was christened. When he hears Catherine's answer, he, Thomas Cromwell, laughs. Nature wronged Catherine, he says, in not making her a man. She would have surpassed all the heroes of antiquity. A paper is put before her, in which she is addressed as Princess Dowager. Shocked, they show him how her pen has ripped through it, as she scores out the new title. Rumours crop in the short summer nights. Dawn finds them like mushrooms in the damp grass. Members of Thomas Cromwell's household have been seeking a midwife in the small hours of the morning. He's hiding a woman at some country house of his, a foreign woman who's given him a daughter. Whatever you do, he says to Ralph, don't defend my honour. I have women like that all over the place. They will believe it, Ralph says. The word in the city is that Thomas Cromwell has a prodigious memory, he says. I have a very large ledger, a huge filing system in which are recorded under their name and also under their offence the details of people who have cut across me. All the astrologers say that the king will have a son, but you are better not to deal with these people.
A man came to him, months ago, offering to make the king a philosopher's stone. And when he was told to make himself scarce, he turned rude and contrary, as these alchemists do, and now gives it out that the king will die this year. Waiting in Saxony, he says, is the eldest son of the late King Edward. You thought him a rattling skeleton beneath the pavements of the tower. Only his murderers know where. You are deceived, for he is a man grown and ready to claim his kingdom. He counts it up. King Edward V, were he living, would be 64 this November coming. He's a bit late to the fight, he says. He puts the alchemist in the tower to rethink his position. No more from Paris. Whatever Maitre Guido's up to, he's very quiet about it. Hans Holbein says, Thomas, I've got your hands done, but I haven't paid much attention to your face. I promise this autumn I'll finish you off. Suppose within every book there is another book, and within every letter on every page, another volume constantly unfolding. But these volumes take no space on the desk. Suppose knowledge could be reduced to a quintessence, held within a picture, a sign, held within a place which is no place. Suppose the human skull were to become capacious, spaces opening inside it, humming chambers like beehives. Lord Mountjoy, Catherine's chamberlain, has sent him a list of all the necessities for the confinement of a Queen of England. It amuses him, the smooth and civil handover, the court and its ceremonies roll on, whoever the personnel. But it is clear, Lord Mountjoy takes him as the man in charge of everything now. He goes down to Greenwich and refurbishes the apartments, ready for Anne. Proclamations, undated, are prepared, to go out to the people of England and the rulers of Europe, announcing the birth of a prince. Just leave a little gap, he suggests, at the end of prince, so, if need be, you can squash in. But they look at him as if he's a traitor, so he leaves off. When a woman withdraws to give birth, the sun may be shining, but the shutters of her room are closed, so she can make her own weather. She's kept in the dark so she can dream. Her dreams drift her far away from terra firma to a marshy tract of land, to a landing stage, to a river where a mist closes over the further bank and earth and sky are inseparate. There she must embark towards life and death, a muffled figure in the stern directing the oars. In this vessel, prayers are said that men never hear. Bargains are struck between a woman and her God. The river is tidal, and between one feather stroke and the next, her tide may turn. On the 26th of August, 1533, a procession escorts the Queen to her sealed rooms at Greenwich. Her husband kisses her, adieu and bon voyage, and she neither smiles nor speaks. She is very pale, very grand, a tiny jewelled head balanced on the swaying tent of her body, her steps small and circumspect, a prayer book in her hands. On the quay, she turns her head, one lingering glance. She sees him, she sees the Archbishop. One last look, and then, her women steadying her elbows, she puts her foot into the boat. Chapter 2 Devil's Spit. Autumn and Winter, 1533. It is magnificent. At the moment of impact, the king's eyes are open, his body braced for the attack. He takes the blow perfectly, its force absorbed by a body securely armoured, moving in the right direction, moving at the right speed. His colour does not alter, his voice does not shake. Healthy, he says. Then I thank God for his favour to us, as I thank you, my lords, for this comfortable intelligence. He thinks Henry has been rehearsing. I suppose we all have. The king walks away towards his own rooms, says over his shoulder, call her Elizabeth, cancel the jousts. A bleat from a Boleyn. The other ceremonies as planned? No reply. Cranmer says all is planned till we hear different. I am to stand godfather to the princess. He falters. He can hardly believe it. For himself, he ordered a daughter, and he got a daughter. His eyes follow Henry's retreating back.
He did not ask after the queen. He did not ask how she does.
It hardly matters, does it? Edward Seymour, saying brutally what everyone is thinking. Then Henry, on his long, solitary walk, stops, turns back. My Lord Archbishop. Cromwell, but you only. In Henry's closet, how do you imagine this? Some would smile. He does not. The king drops into a chair. The urge arises to put a hand on his shoulder, as one does for any inconsolable being. He resists it, simply folds his fingers, protectively, into the fist which holds the king's heart. One day we will make a great marriage for her. Poor Scrap. Her own mother will wish her away.
Your Majesty is young enough, Cranmer says. The Queen is strong and her family are fertile. You can get another child soon, and perhaps God intends some peculiar blessing by this princess.
My dear friend, I am sure you are right. Henry sounds dubious, but he looks around to take strength from his surroundings, as if God might have left some friendly message written on the wall. Though there is only precedent for the hostile kind. He takes a breath and stands up and shakes out his sleeves. He smiles, and one can catch in flight, as if it were a bird with a strong beating heart, the act of will that transforms a desolate wretch into the beacon of his nation. He whispers to Cranmer later, "It was like watching Lazarus get up." Soon, Henry is striding about the palace at Greenwich, putting the celebrations underway. "We are young enough," he says, "and next time it will be a boy. One day we will make a great marriage for her. Believe me, God intends some peculiar blessing by this princess." Boleyn faces Brighton. It's Sunday, 4 p.m. He goes and laughs a bit at the clerks who have "Prince" written on their proclamations, and who now have to squeeze extra letters in. Then he goes back to working out the expenses for the new princess's household. He has advised that Gertrude, Lady Exeter, be among the child's godparents. Why should only the maid have a vision of her? It'll do her good to be seen by the whole court, smiling a forced smile and holding Anne's baby at the font. The maid herself, brought to London, is kept in a private house, where the beds are soft and the voices around her, the voices of Cromwell women, hardly disturb her prayers. Where the key is turned in the oiled lock with a click as small as the snap of a bird's bone. "Does she eat?" he asks Mercy, and she says, "She eats as heartily as you." "Well, no, Thomas, perhaps not quite so heartily as you. I wonder what happened to her project of living on the communion host."
"They can't see her dining now, can they? Those priests and monks who set her on this course?"
Away from their scrutiny, the nun has started to act like an ordinary woman, acknowledging the simple claims of her body, like anyone who wants to live. But it may be too late. He likes it that Mercy doesn't say, "Ah, the poor harmless soul." That she is not harmless by nature is clear, when they have her over to Lambeth Palace to question her. You would think Lord Chancellor Audley, his chain of office hung about his splendid person, would be enough to subdue any country girl. Throw in the Archbishop of Canterbury, and you would imagine a young nun might feel some awe, not a bit of it. The maid treats Cranmer with condescension, as if he were a novice in the religious life, when he challenges her on any point and says,
"How did you know that?"
She smiles pityingly and says,
"An angel told me."
Audley brings Richard Rich with him to their second session, to take notes for them, and put any points that occur to him. He is Sir Richard now, knighted and promoted to Solicitor General. In his student days he was known for a sharp, slanderous tongue, for irreverence to his seniors, for drinking and gaming for high stakes. But who would hold up his head if people judged us by what we were like at 20? Rich turns out to have a talent for drafting legislation, which is second only to his own. His features, beneath his soft, fair hair, are pinched with concentration. The boys call him Sir Purse. You'd never think to see him precisely laying out his papers that he was once the great disgrace of the Inner Temple. He says so in an undertone, teasing him, while they wait for the girl to be brought in. "Well, Master Cromwell," Rich says, "what about you and that abbess in Halifax?" He knows better than to deny it, or any of those stories the Cardinal told about him. "Oh, that," he says. "It was nothing. They expected in Yorkshire." He is afraid the girl may have caught the tail end of the exchange, because today, as she takes the chair they have placed for her, she gives him a particularly hard stare. She arranges her skirts, folds her arms, and waits for them to entertain her. His niece, Alice Wellyfed, sits on a stool by the door, just there in case of fainting or other upset. Though a glance at the maid tells you, she's no more likely to faint than Audley is. "Shall I," Rich says, "start?" "Oh, why not?" Audley says. "You are young and hearty. These prophecies of yours, you are always changing the timing of the disaster you foresee. But I understood you said that the king would not reign 1 month after he married Lady Anne. Well, the months have passed. Lady Anne is crowned queen and has given the king a fine daughter. So what do you say now?"
"I say in the eyes of the world he seems to be king. But in the eyes of God," she shrugs, "not any more. He is no more the real king than he," she nods towards Cranmer, "is really archbishop."
Rich is not to be sidetracked. "So, it would be justified to raise rebellion against him, to depose him, to assassinate him, to put another in his place?"
"Well, what do you think?"
"And among the claimants, your choice has fallen on the Courtenay family, not the Poles. Henry, Marquis of Exeter, not Henry, Lord Montague. Or," he says sympathetically, "do you get them mixed up?"
"Of course not," she flushes. "I have met both those gentlemen."
Rich makes a note. Audley says, "Now, Courtenay, that is Lord Exeter, descends from a daughter of King Edward. Lord Montague descends from King Edward's brother, the Duke of Clarence. How do you weigh their claims? Because if we are talking of true kings and false kings, some say Edward was a bastard his mother got by an archer. I wonder if you can cast any light."
"Why would she?" Rich says. Audley rolls his eyes.
"Because she talks to the saints on high. They'd know."
He looks at Rich, and it is as if he can read his thoughts. Niccolo's book says, "The wise prince exterminates the envious, and if I, Rich, were king, those claimants and their families would be dead." The girl is braced for the next question. How is it she has seen two queens in her vision? "I suppose it will sort itself out," he says, "in the fighting. It's good to have a few kings and queens in reserve, if you're going to start a war in a country."
"It is not necessary to have a war," the nun says.
"Oh?" Sir Purse sits up. "This is new."
"God is sending a plague on England instead. Henry will be dead in 6 months. So will she, Thomas Boleyn's daughter."
"And me?"
"You too."
"And all in this room, except you, of course. All including Alice Wellyfed, who never did you harm?"
"All the women of your house are heretics, and the plague will rot them body and soul."
"And what about the Princess Elizabeth?"
She turns in her seat to aim her words at Cranmer.
"They say when you christened her, you warmed the water to spare her a shock. You should have poured it boiling."
"Oh, Christ in heaven," Rich says. He throws his pen down. He is a tender young father with a daughter in the cradle.
He drops a consoling hand on his, the Solicitor General's. You would think Alice would need consoling, but when the maid condemned her to death, he had looked down the room at his niece to note that her face was the perfect picture of derision. He says to Rich, "She didn't think it up herself, the boiling water. It is the thing they're saying on the streets." Cranmer huddles into himself. The maid has bruised him. She has scored a point. He, Cromwell, says, "I saw the princess yesterday. She is thriving in spite of her ill wishes." His voice suggests calm. "We must get the Archbishop back in the saddle." He turns to the maid. "Tell me, did you locate the Cardinal?"
"What?"
Audley says. "Dame Elizabeth said she would look out for my old master on one of her excursions to heaven, hell, and purgatory, and I offered to pay her travelling expenses on the occasion. I gave her people a down payment. I hope we see some progress."
"Wolsey would have had another 15 years of life," the girl says.
He nods. He has said the same himself.
"But then God cut him off as an example. I have seen devils disputing for his soul."
"You know the result?" he asks.
"There is no result. I searched for him all over. I thought God had extinguished him. Then one night I saw him."
A long, tactical hesitation.
"I saw his soul seated among the unborn."
There is a silence. Cranmer shrinks in his seat. Rich gently nibbles the end of his pen. Audley twists a button on his sleeve, round and round till the thread tightens.
"If you like, I can pray for him," the maid says. "God usually answers my requests."
"Formerly, when you had your advisers about you, Father Bocking and Father Gold and Father Risby and the rest, you would start bargaining at this point. I would propose a further sum for your goodwill, and your spiritual directors would drive it up."
"Wait,"
Cranmer lays a hand over his ribcage.
"Can we go back, Lord Chancellor?"
"We can go in any direction you choose, my Lord Archbishop. 3 times round the mulberry bush."
"You see devils?"
She nods.
"They appear how?"
"Birds."
"A relief,"
Audley says dryly.
"No, sir. Lucifer stinks. His claws are deformed. He comes as a cockerel smeared in blood and shit."
He looks up at Alice. He is ready to send her out. He thinks, what has been done to this woman?
Cranmer says, "That must be disagreeable for you. But it is a characteristic of devils, I understand, to show themselves in more than one way."
"Yes, they do it to deceive you. He comes as a young man."
"Indeed."
"Once he brought a woman to my cell at night."
She pauses.
"Pouring her,"
Rich says. "He is known to have no shame."
"No more than you."
"And what then, Dame Elizabeth, after the pouring?"
"Pulled up her skirts."
"And she didn't resist," Rich says. "You surprise me." Audley says,
"Prince Lucifer, I don't doubt he has a way with him."
"Before my eyes, he had to do with her on my bed."
Rich makes a note. "This woman, did you know her?" No answer. "And the devil did not try the same with you? You can speak freely. It will not be held against you."
"He came to sweet-talk me, swaggering in his blue silk coat, it's the best he has, and new hose with diamonds down his legs."
"Diamonds down his legs," he says. "Now that must have been a temptation." She shakes her head. "But you are a fine young woman, good enough for any man, I'd say." She looks up, a flicker of a smile.
"I am not for Master Lucifer."
"What did he say when you refused him?"
"He asked me to marry him."
Audley puts his head in his hands.
"I said I was vowed to chastity."
Was he not angry when you would not consent?
Oh, yes, he spat in my face.
I would expect no better of him, Rich says.
I wiped his spit off with a napkin. It's black. It has the stench of hell.
What is that like?
Like something rotting.
Where is it now, the napkin? I suppose you didn't send it to the laundry.
Dom Edward has it.
Does he show it to people for money?
For offerings.
For money. Cranmer takes his face from his hands.
Shall we pause?
A quarter hour, Rich says. Audley says. I told you he was young and hearty.
Perhaps we will meet tomorrow, Cranmer says. I need to pray, and a quarter of an hour will not do it.
But tomorrow is Sunday, the nun says. There was a man who went out hunting on a Sunday, and he fell down a bottomless pit into hell. Imagine that.
How is it bottomless? Rich asks. If hell was there to receive him. I wish I were going hunting, Audley says. Christ knows I'll take a chance on it. Alice rises from her stool and signals for her escort. The maid gets to her feet. She is smiling broadly. She has made the Archbishop flinch and himself grow cold, and the Solicitor General all but weep with her talk of scalded babies. She thinks she is winning, but she is losing, losing, losing all the time. Alice puts a gentle hand on her arm, but the maid shakes it off. Outside, Richard Rich says, "We should burn her." Cranmer says,
"Much as we may dislike her talk of the late Cardinal appearing to her, the devil's in her bedchamber, she speaks in this way because she has been taught to ape the claims of certain nuns who have gone before her, nuns whom Rome is pleased to recognise as saints. I cannot convict them of heresy, retrospectively, nor have I evidence to try her for heresy."
"Burn for treason, I meant." "It is the woman's penalty, where a man is half hanged and castrated, then slowly gutted by the executioner." He says, "There is no overt action. She has only expressed an intent." "Intent to raise rebellion, to depose the king. Should that not be treason? Words have been construed as treasons. There are precedents, you know them." "I shall be astonished," Audley says, "if they have escaped Cromwell's attention." It is as if they can smell the devil's spit. They are almost jostling each other to get into the air, which is mild, damp. A faint scent of leaves, a green-gold rustling light. He can see that in the years ahead treason will take new and various forms. When the last Treason Act was made, no one could circulate their words in a printed book or bill, because printed books were not thought of. He feels a moment of jealousy towards the dead, to those who served kings in slower times than these. Nowadays, the products of some bought or poisoned brain can be disseminated through Europe in a month. "I think new laws are needed," Rich says. "I have it in hand. And I think this woman is too leniently kept. We are too soft. We are just playing with her." Cranmer walks away, shoulders stooped, his trailing habit brushing up the leaves. Audley turns to him, bright and resolute, a man keen to change the subject. "So, the princess, you say she was well?" The princess, unswaddled, had been placed on cushions at Anne's feet, an ugly, purple, grizzling knot of womankind, with an upstanding ruff of pale hair, and a habit of kicking up her gown, as if to display her most unfortunate feature. It seems stories have been put about that Anne's child was born with teeth, has six fingers on each hand, and is furred all over like a monkey. So her father has shown her off naked to the ambassadors, and her mother is keeping her on display in the hope of countering the rumours. The king has chosen Hatfield for her seat, and Anne says, "It seems to me waste might be saved, and the proper order of things asserted, if Spanish Mary's household were broken up, and she were to become a member of the household of the Princess Elizabeth, my daughter." In the capacity of... The child is quiet.
only, he notes, because she has crammed a fist into her maw and is cannibalizing herself. In the capacity of my daughter's servant, what else should she be? There can be no pretense at equality. Mary is a bastard. The brief respite is over. The princess sets up a screech that would bring out the dead. Anne's glance slides away sideways, and a sideways grin of infatuation takes over her whole face, and she leans down towards her daughter. But at once women swoop, flapping and bustling. The screaming creature is plucked up, wrapped up, swept away, and the queen's eyes follow pitifully as the fruit of her womb exits in procession. He says gently, "I think she was hungry."
This ends Disc 16.